Welcome to It's About Florida, a weekly discussion program tackling the key topics of interest to our state. I'm Lynn Hatter. Today we're breaking down the results of several state and congressional races and the presidential election. We're joined by a special panel of guests as we take a closer look at the results and what they mean for Florida's future. Joining us in the studio, we have Dr. Carol Weissert, who's a political scientist at Florida State University.
Good morning.
We have Kathleen Hogney, who is a reporter with the Sun Sentinel.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
And we have Dara Kam, who also is the reporter for the Palm Beach Post. Welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
So yesterday, we had our presidential election. We had a lot of key races on this ballot. There was a lot going on. One of the longest ballots in Florida history. Dr. Weissert, tell us a little bit about kind of the setup going into this election cycle.
Well, it was a presidential year, which is quite different from the last time we voted in Florida in 2010, where the Republicans in Florida and around the rest of the country did extraordinarily well. In an election year, a presidential election year, you get a bigger turnout. You get, in this case, more Democrats coming out. And so a lot more engagement in the race. And then, as you mentioned, we did have these 11 constitutional amendments on the ballot, which made the ballot quite long. And if you hadn't read it before and you were just reading it for the first time, it could be quite laborious to go through that ballot. And it probably did contribute to some long lines in the state.
Yeah, we heard many reports of long lines. There were really long wait times going down in South Florida, a lot of them in, I guess, the Miami area. And we even got word at about 12:30 as of Wednesday morning, there were still people standing in line in some places.
Well, I mean, I think as Dr. Weissert said, I mean, the ballots were long. A lot of people were excited about coming out to vote because it's a presidential election. I think last time I looked at the State Division of Elections website, turnout statewide was just over 70%. So you had a lot of people that were really excited to come out and cast their ballot. And each county sort of dealt with it in their own way. Obviously, over the weekend, there was a lot of coverage of people who were in long lines for early voting. Some of the counties, particularly Miami-Dade, Broward and Palm Beach tried to alleviate that situation by having people come in and cast absentee ballots in person. But, you know, for last night, there wasn't really much they could do other than wait it out. If you were in line by 7 p.m., you got to cast your ballot.
And there was some confusion, though, with polling and precinct places. I think I saw a couple of reports that were coming out, one out of Duval, where there were people who were confused about which precinct they were supposed to go to, others who said that they were being told to vote a provisional ballot if they were at the wrong precinct. There was a lot of that, maybe not in every county, but I know for a fact that that was happening in Jacksonville and Duval. Did anybody else hear any reports on that one?
I didn't hear any reports on that one, but there were pockets of problems throughout the state. Part of that may have been caused by a new election law that changed the rules about where you could change your address and when you could change your address if you moved within the county. And if you moved out of the county, there was a lot of concern about that. There was concern, and some folks are saying that are attributing those long lines to the shortening of the early vote period from 14 days to 8 days, although the number of hours Republicans who dominate the legislature and pass that election law are quick to point out that the number of hours didn't shrink, but the number of days did. And so there's a concern that contributed to the long lines in early voting. And there's also the sense, perhaps, that an outrage or a sense of concern about these voter laws changing may have goaded people into voting, in addition to the fact that it was a presidential year. But people who I spoke with And certainly some of the left-leaning groups and the Democrats mm-hmm. made a big point, and there were lawsuits, and made a big point of these changes. In fact, the Democrats called these the voter suppression law that Florida and many other states with Republican-dominated legislatures passed these election changes, some of them even more strident than Florida's regarding voter ID. But the sense that people were concerned about their vote not counting, and that their right to vote was being taken away from them may have contributed even, I don't know, Dr. Weissert, what you think, but the some of the folks I'm talking to said that that helped drive out vote, in addition, of course, to the Obama ground game, mm-hmm. which was just phenomenal in the state and targeted some of those same voters.
Yes, I think that's true. I know that the Obama campaign particularly was looking to college students. And here at Florida State and other places, there was a great educational effort underway to let students know that they couldn't just vote a regular ballot if they had changed, even if they had voted within the county. So I think there was a large effort to inform people. I actually think, too, that the fact that the governor refused to extend the early voting time, even though his two Republican predecessors had, was another thing that sort of annoyed people and maybe made them stay in line a little longer.
Because there were some power voters. I mean, at about 12:30 this morning, there was a couple of reports in Miami of people still standing in line. You know, there is.
Sure. And of course, you know, I mean, I was listening to people on CNN or MSNBC last night, and I think it was Rachel Maddow or someone from MSNBC was saying, well, you know, we've already called the race. You know, the voters in Miami-Dade can go home now. Well, of course, there's other things on the ballot than the presidential election, as we know. In Florida, we had, I think it was the longest ballot in history in some places. And a number of legislative races, I guess we'll talk about that,
that were
pretty important, as well as those amendments.
Yeah, I was going to say, before we get on to the legislative races, I think the amendments were really telling.
Yeah.
I thought it was a good night for Florida voters in that they clearly read those amendments, even though they were wordy and very hard to understand, and they picked out the ones that they wanted.
Mm-hmm. See, I disagree with you. I don't know that they read – I mean, they were so long and so confusing, and they came at the end for most people, unless there were, you know, local referenda following mm-hmm. them. In a sense, I don't know that voters got all the way through them because the legislature put those on the ballot. They're
right.
not limited to that 75
right.
word restriction
right.
that citizens initiatives are limited to the number mm-hmm. of words that can be on the ballot. Very lengthy, very complicated. The titles of some of them were simple: religious freedom,
healthcare freedom,
healthcare.
Right.
But when you actually read them, I mean, I would imagine that some people got halfway through Amendment 4, which was a very complicated property tax changes mm-hmm. that was backed by the Florida Realtors, in which, you know, there were more.
There
than
was also a lot of spending in that one. That one
more than five
drew
million.
The most money toward it. Let's go ahead and get into those campaigns, and we're going to let Kathleen get a word in.
I just responded to that real quickly. Here's why I think that it is really important, and that is because that I think if they had been sort of overcome by the verbiage, then they would have voted no on everything. But they didn't. I mean, you know, they picked out the property tax ones to combat people who had just come back from the military and to the poor and to widows and that kind of thing. So they weren't just the first ones. I mean, they really did discriminate there. And there were also some differences in the percentages by which it was rejected. I was interested that the one that really did the worst was the court one, the one that would have changed the way that we handle appointments to the court and have them approved by the Senate. And that was also a case that went along with the fact that 2/3 of the voters supported the judges retaining the mm-hmm. Supreme Court judges, even though they had been actively opposed. So I think the fact that they had, they picked and chose a little bit in there, and then it made, you know, there were differences. That's why I think that it was a good night for voters.
Just one more thing, though. They did drop. There were about a million fewer voters. There were about 8 million,
sure.
more than 8 million voters who voted for the presidential race, and that number dropped down by about a million in those.
And that's very common.
Yeah, because most people kind of tend to skip over the amendments. We've also seen that in elections past. Let's go ahead and get into those. Kathleen, let's talk about some of these provisions that were on the ballot. You had a couple hot button ones. A lot of people called them kind of the issues ballot because you had one that dealt with was kind of a side note to the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, Amendment 1, that would have stopped the state legislature from instituting what a lot of people think of as universal health care. You had Amendment 6, which dealt with public funding for abortions. How did they fare?
Well, you have to keep in mind it's incredibly difficult to get a constitutional amendment passed. There's a 60% threshold that voters have to get to get an amendment passed. But I think what you'll see in the coming days is that the Democrats will certainly pick up that line where they will say that voters were disgusted that the Republicans pushed too far on their agenda. You've seen a little bit of that already. Obviously, Republicans are going to reject that and say, you know, use the 60% threshold as the reason why they just couldn't get there. But we'll see. You know, what happens if they try to come back with some of these ideas.
I mean, and then there was the issue with the Florida Supreme Court justices. Obviously, Justices Perriente, Quince, and Lewis, I think, were all up for merit retention votes.
Well, you know, in 2010, I think we started to see this group out of Orlando that started talking about justices that were up for retention and started saying, well, you should look at what they're voting on. You know, sorry, I'm blanking on the gentleman's name who runs the group, but
yeah, Jesse,
and sorry, I'm forgetting his last name, but you know, he started to try to bring this up, but he didn't have a lot of money, kind of just got ignored basically. But you know, you fast forward two years later. And he's still there. He was starting to raise money. He was starting to bring it up. And you saw the Republican Party's executive committee come out and take a vote to suggest to their members that you should vote these justices down. And that just hadn't happened in recent history. And there was a lot of criticism, both from Democrats and some people even within the Republican Party, that the party should not be going anywhere near that issue, that it was a danger to, you know, that it was going to politicize judicial retention races. And, you know, I think there was a lot of hype that the justices were in very competitive races now and they were having to campaign. Obviously, I don't know how many of you were using Hulu in the past couple weeks, but every time I went to watch a show on Hulu, I would see an ad for either Justice Quince, Justice Lewis, or Justice Perriente, which I thought was really interesting. You know, most of the time these justices don't have to even campaign. But at the end of the day, we saw, you know, they overwhelmingly were supported by the voters.
I mean, and they were out and about. They were, you know, talking, even leading up about the merit retention process, which I thought was something really interesting to actually see a sitting Supreme Court justice actually saying, yes, you know, I can't tell you to vote for me, but I would really like for you to vote for me. It was kind of one of those things, and they did it often.
You're listening to It's About Florida. We've been hearing from a special panel of guests on the results of the 2012 general election, Florida ballot initiatives, and several key state and congressional races.
Something interesting, let's go ahead and get into some of these state races, because Democrats had probably one of their best election nights in a while. They managed to stir up the pot a bit and unseat some key state legislative leaders. Chris Dorworth is looking like he may be going down to defeat. You had the big Sachs and Bogdanoff race which basically pitted two sitting state senators into the same district. Scott Plakin was another, you know, very strong legislator who lost his race. But on the grand scheme of things, I mean, how big of a dent did this make for Republicans? How big of a hit did they take?
Well, I think in the short term, I mean, you can say not a whole lot changed here because, I mean, Republicans still have commanding control over the House, Senate, and obviously the executive. But, you know, what I think a lot of people within the both parties are probably looking at is 2 years down the line. You know, you saw a lot of these races get competitive where maybe it wasn't expected originally. And you have to keep in mind that a lot of candidates were recruited before anyone knew what the political maps were going to look like. I mean, they were trying to get people to run saying, we don't really know what your district's going to look like, which could potentially scare people away. You know, you want to know all the facts before you jump in and say, hey, I'm going to run for state rep or state senate. So, you know, for the next election cycle, they would have 2 full years to recruit on a map where they know what it's going to look like, raise money. So, I think that will be the real test of whether this new map is more favorable to them and they can really change their fortunes in Florida politics.
The Democrats also did something significant in the House, though, and that is that the Republicans no longer have a supermajority in that chamber. That's a huge deal for Democrats who have – and part of the reason why they may have had a hard time recruiting candidates is because, you know, they're effectively emasculated in that chamber. They really – unlike in the Senate, where Democrats are able – have – historically been able to band together with more moderate Republicans to stop key pieces of legislation. Mm-hmm. Democrats in the House have not been able to do that. For things like constitutional amendments, they require a two-thirds majority to pass. So the Democrats are, you know, this was a big turning point for the Democrats in terms of regaining at least a modicum of power in that chamber. I agree that, you know, what this sets the stage for 2 years from now and certainly will give them, you know, a feeling of confidence going into recruiting those candidates. Again, the legislature redrew those legislative and congressional districts after voters in 2 years ago passed a constitutional amendment that was aimed at doing away with gerrymandered districts that favored incumbents or political parties. So I think this is the first election that we're seeing after those new districts have been drawn. And I think that this sort of demonstrates that the legislature did implement those new districts in a way that allowed Democrats to be able to take some of those seats. One of those seats is that new district that Ellen Bogdanoff, a Republican from state senator from Fort Lauderdale, and Maria Sachs, a Democrat from Delray Beach, fought over. That it was a new district that was a leaned Democrat. It was a couple – Democrats had a couple of point advantage in that race, but it was a very, very expensive, brutal race. I know Kathleen wrote a lot about it. And Maria Sachs won comfortably, you know, I forget what the final –
I think it was about 5%.
Okay, yeah. So she a bigger portion of those votes were in Palm Beach County. She is from Palm Beach. That may have been part of it. Also, a Democrat leaning, but that was a big victory also for the Democrats.
And also they won the U.S. Senate seat. We shouldn't forget that.
Yeah.
So Bill Nelson did win very substantially. And then they also picked up some congressional seats. Yeah. There were a couple of open seats and then a couple of incumbents who lost their way. So,
I was going to say the Patrick Murphy, Alan West Republican
firebrands. And I will tell you, I just got off the phone with our reporter down there, and so Alan West is asking for a recount in St. Lucie County. So that one may be up in the air, but it appears that is, you know, he's a Tea Party icon.
I want to target a couple of these races because I think they're just really interesting. What happened to Chris Dorworth? His race was one that a lot of people just thought that he was just going to walk in easy breezy and win re-election. And then all of a sudden, he's now basically a couple votes, you know, away from possibly
37
votes away from losing. What happened in this race? He was supposed to be House Speaker, I think, in what, 2014?
Right. Well, I mean, it should have been an easy race for him. I mean, the district was drawn so that it was strongly Republican. It was a safe district for him. But you also have to remember he's gotten an incredibly high amount of bad press in the past year. He's come under heavy criticism for spending money out of his political committee. There have been accusations about some of his spendings with the Republican Party, some of his activities there. I think after a while, voters were starting to notice. But I would still say that it came as a surprise to most people last night when it appeared he was in very close to losing and may indeed lose. I mean, we'll probably see a recount. I think the earliest it could start was maybe Friday.
And that was when he outspent his opponent something like 8-1.
Right.
So this was one race where just pouring a lot of money did not necessarily bring victory.
And it also had an impact on on Scott Plakin's race, really, because he and Plakin both lived in that same district when
it
was created. And Plakin moved and had to go to a more competitive district. And as we saw last night, Karen Kasser Dentel was able to defeat Plakin.
Scott Plakin, strong conservative, really kind of toes the party line, got drawn, actually moved from his district to avoid running against Dorworth, moved into a more competitive district where he faced Kasser Dentel. Now, this is an interesting race, I think, because Kasser Dentel is the daughter of Betty Kasser, and I think she's the sister of Congresswoman Kasser.
All women, I might add.
Political dynasty. Democratic dynasty. Yeah.
And then, talking about political dynasties down in Miami, Alex Diaz de la Portilla lost his race. There would have been two in the legislature. Now there's just still one. I mean, I'm pretty sure that one probably came as a shocker, too.
Alex Diaz de la Portilla is another. He's a former Senate majority leader, very, very powerful and influential, was a former state representative. And I don't believe that he has ever lost a race that he's been involved in and is part of a Cuban-American political dynasty, the Diaz de la Portillas. They've served on the school board. And so that's got to be a surprise. I haven't spoken with anyone in Miami-Dade today, but that has got to be a shocker for the former senator And it does, we were talking earlier, speak, I think, somewhat to the changing demographics among voters in Florida.
A lot more Hispanic voters in those districts, starting to trend, I think, a little younger, too.
They're second, third generation Cuban Americans. They're not as conservative as their parents were. There's a lot of Puerto Rican and other kind of Hispanics that have moved in there. And so Democrats have targeted that part of the Hispanic community. The Obama campaign and other left-leaning groups have targeted that particular demographic in registering Democrats this year. The discussion about immigration on the national level and the DREAM Act and being able – that issue really resonates among those voters.
The exit polls from the race really showed that in terms of the presidential race, the Hispanics in Florida supported Obama 60-39%. But the more interesting thing for me was that Obama carried the people of Cuban descent. So that really runs against everything we know about the Cuban-American voters in Florida. But the reason is exactly the one you said. The younger voters, the younger Cuban-American voters voted for Obama.
You know, with some of these kind of key state races, I wonder if, in my mind, our legislature has, for the last couple of years, grown increasingly conservative. And I wonder, with the defeat of certain candidates, if this may not have, shaken statewide politics up a little bit more, made Democrats more competitive, and might even actually lead to some of the Republican Party leaders maybe rethinking some of their positions in future legislatures. I mean, we still have to go through another round in another 2 years when the other half of folks will be up.
So I think you're going to see Republican leaders in Florida and party leaders and legislative leaders courting the Hispanic vote. I mean, they've got I think this was a national wake-up call for Republicans in terms of what they have to do to court Hispanics. I don't know that you're going to see them rethinking their policies or the ones who are in there now. Good example, the new Senate President Don Gates. I was on the phone with him this morning. He said to me that he didn't think that this rejection of these amendments were a mandate about a Republican, you know, far-reaching by a Republican-dominated legislature. He didn't think that he wouldn't speak to the House races, but I don't think you're going to see a rethinking in terms of the leaders. You do have Will Weatherford, maybe a little bit more of a moderate over in the House, maybe not as strong of a leader as Dean Cannon was. But they're going to have to face the fact that because of this new way they have to draw these districts, they are going to have to put more effort into some of these races. I was on the phone with Marian Johnson from the Florida Chamber this morning, and she said that there are 23 House races that after redistricting, Democrats could have a good chance of winning. So they've won six of those. The rest of them will be up in 2014. So a long answer, I think, yes, they're going to look at courting Hispanic voters. Are they going to move more – are Republicans in Florida going to move more towards the center in order to be more successful in the future? I think that's a huge question that remains to be seen.
Here's my concern. 2014 is another off-presidential election. Mm-hmm. And in off-presidential elections, you don't have the youth turnout. You don't have, honestly, some of the big turnout that we had here. So if I'm a Republican, I'm thinking, well, you know, we survived this. We'll win in 2014. And then we'll worry about it again in 2016. So that's my concern, that it's a blip on the screen. They say, okay, this is an aberration. 2014, we're going to be back in the power again.
Kathleen?
Well, yeah, I think I'd agree with Dr. Weisert here. I mean, I and Dara, I mean, I think they are probably going to stick to their guns. I think Representative Weatherford said this morning he's, you know, not going to back down from his agenda. I think Senator Gates is probably going to take the same approach. He's, you know, Senator Gates in particular tends to be very strong about his opinions and what he wants to do. I'm sure he is already planning a full legislative agenda for the spring, which he did. The only thing he has mentioned really in depth so far is he wants to do an ethics reform bill, which I think will probably play well with both parties. Actually, that you know doesn't seem to have a party attached to it. But yeah, I think that Republicans probably do have the mindset that they can hold on 2 years from now if they just keep doing what they've been doing. Obviously, they have proven for the last decade or so that they're much better organized than the Florida Democratic Party. They raise a heck of a lot more money. And, in most cases, money can trump everything. If you put a lot of ads out there, you can get your message across and get the attention of the voters.
Well, ladies, thank you so much for joining us today on It's About Florida. Dr. Weisert, political scientist at Florida State University, Kathleen Hogney, reporter for the Sun Sentinel, and Ms. Dara Kam, reporter for the Palm Beach Post. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks to Florida State University's Carol Weisert, the Sun Sentinel's Kathleen Hogney, and the Palm Beach Post's Dara Kam. You've been listening to It's About Florida, a production of WFSU-FM. I'm Lynn Hatter, and for our regular host, Tramell Gomes. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance. Please join us again next week for more discussions on the issues impacting our state.